You may have seen the headlines some time ago about Cork woman Rachel Ford, who was caught with more than €26,000 worth of cocaine in a makeup bag after a Garda raid on her home. What those headlines couldn't tell was the story behind it. The addiction, the painkiller dependency that spiralled out of control, the psychosis, the sleepless nights, the fear, the shame, and the impact it had on her family and her children. This week on the podcast, Rachel joins me to tell the full story behind one of the darkest periods of her life. From taking up to 90 strong painkillers a day, to experiencing drug-induced psychosis, to the moment Gardaí raided her home, Rachel speaks openly and honestly about her battle with addiction and the long road that followed. But this isn't a story about drugs. It's a story about recovery, redemption, and second chances. Today, Rachel is rebuilding her life, helping others in recovery, and proving that no matter how far you've fallen, there's always way back. This is a powerful conversation about hitting rock bottom, finding hope, and making a comeback. If this story resonates with you, please leave a comment and hit that subscribe button. It really helps. And as always, this episode is proudly sponsored by ADHD Now, the online clinic transforming ADHD assessment and care across Ireland. If you are seeking an ADHD assessment or support, visit ADHDnow.com today. This is The Comeback with Rachel Ford.
Rachel, delighted to see you again after all these years. I always start a podcast, if I know the person, I've met the person with how I know the person. And I think it was, I must have been 5 years ago now, your first on air here in Red FM.
Maybe six, I'd say.
Is it six?
Yeah, I'd say so.
And then you were working in a salon.
Yeah.
That I would be attending. Always so lovely, Rachel. And I had no idea that you'd been going through so much. Same as many other people. Yeah. Nobody knows what anyone is going through.
No.
And you've been through the mill, like the stuff that has happened to you. And I'm so delighted to see you doing so well.
Thank you.
You have completely turned your life around.
Full 360.
Like full 360. And when I asked you on the podcast first, you were kind of like, me? Why would you want me to come on? Wasn't you were...
Yeah, I suppose loads of self-doubt.
Yeah.
You know, like, why me? Like, why would I be good enough for a podcast?
There's no one who's not good enough for my podcast. Everyone has a story. Mm. But your story, you're going to help so many people. And I'm so delighted for you. You recently celebrated 3 years sobriety.
Yeah, I did.
And we'll get to that. But there's been a lot going on since that. But for how I start all of my podcasts, Rachel Ford, can you tell me where you grew up and what was it like?
Yes. I had a very, very normal life. Very normal life. I went to school. I went to primary school. I went to secondary school. My dad worked. My mum was at home with us. Well, she did work on and off. But then when she had my youngest sibling, she kind of gave up work. We had a nice life. You know, we always had foreign holidays. We never really wanted for much. I spent an awful lot of my childhood with my beautiful grandmother every single weekend and whenever I could in between. So, like I said, I am one of five. So there's four girls and one boy. I fell pregnant on my first son. And I had another baby. I was a very young mum. But I got, like, you know, I got on with it.
Yeah.
I always worked. I kind of started hairdressing when I was about 14 or 15, I suppose. And I loved it. I did. But I could never settle, Brenda.
Yeah, okay.
Do you know, I always had itchy feet and I always had the sense of not belonging. You know, feeling different to everybody and everything. You know, it didn't have to be a person. It was a place, you know. A place, a feeling, an emotion. I just always felt typically less than, but different, I suppose, is one of the main feelings that I felt. And I didn't know that that's how I felt for a very long time. I just knew that I was unsettled, if you could say that.
Yeah.
You know, I could never settle with anything except by myself. I thought I thrived in isolation. Looking back now, isolation was detrimental for me.
Yeah.
Absolutely detrimental for me.
Especially what was going to happen years down the line.
Yeah.
We know isolation is the worst thing in the world when it comes to addiction. Mm. Tell me, at what age did you try your first drink or drug?
Oh, I was about 12 or 13. I'm going to say 12 is when I first picked up a drink.
Do you remember where it was?
I do. The IDA in Dublin Hill. I do. A 2 litre of cider. Me and my friend, we went up for sup on the 2 litre Linden Village. And I absolutely hated the taste of it.
Right.
And I'd say from my first drink till my very, very last drink up until today, it made me vomit.
Drink any drink?
Always. Because I drank alcoholically from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know that then. But I, like, in hindsight, I know that now. I hated the taste of alcohol. I never, ever liked it, really. But I absolutely loved what it did for me.
Can you remember when you were 12 that night drinking the Linden Village with your friend, a bit of a release or kind of
a huge release?
Right.
Like, I remember, you know, when you get that little bit of a feeling going, this is it. This is it. This is what I've been missing. I could talk to people. I could laugh at people. I thought I was funny. I obviously wasn't. You know, I had a little bit of confidence. But Brenda, I must emphasise that that feeling was very short-lived. But I spent the next 20 years, I suppose, chasing that back.
And then when you were in school as a teenager, was it a case like many of us would have gone out the weekends, gone to the disco, drank?
Yeah, do you know?
Like normally, like all your other friends, or were you kind of, did you ever find yourself drinking more than your friends or drinking faster? Or?
I suppose it all started with drink, but for me, it quickly escalated to other substances. Not long after I had my first drink, I suppose I started with the slang, I suppose, buzzing off petrol and buzzing from deodorant and things like that. That was probably my first incident with substance abuse. And I loved that high.
Sniffing them.
Deodorant cans were a big thing for me for a while. And I actually had a conversation with my partner about it probably only 2 or 3 weeks ago. We were in the car and I don't know how it came up. But I suppose with our children now at that age, like, it was actually upsetting for the both of us. We were like the kids are older.
Yeah.
Than when I started. If I even thought for a second that our kids at that age were in that much pain, Brenda, you know, that they had to go and find an outlet. And I did. I found an outlet in substances.
And can I ask, what was the pain from, Rachel? Do you know back then what it was? You probably didn't know at the time, but in later years you figure out what it was.
I suppose it's like, I fully believe that I was born with this disease, you know, because up until later in my life, I had no real traumatic experience. You know, as I just explained there, my childhood was a very, very normal childhood. In some instances, people would say it was nearly a privileged childhood. You know, like, I came from a large family, Brenda, and we didn't want for anything as such. You know, we always had foreign holidays. I always had meals at home, which is a huge privilege for any child, you know. I always had meals at home. I always had clothes. Now, they might have been handed in for my older sisters, but I still had clothes, you know. I didn't want for anything. I think that I was born with this disease of addiction.
A chemical imbalance.
Yeah. And I feel like I thought drink and other substances were my remedy.
Yeah. And you know what the thing is? And you'll hear people, and even on Neil's show, and they go back sometimes kind of saying, oh, there has to be trauma. For some people, there's no trauma. Like, for some people, there's no trauma. And that's okay too. Like, as you're saying, you were born with it. I don't like to speak about myself too much on the podcast. I'm the exact same. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful childhood, the most amazing family.
Yeah.
There was nothing there. It's just there. Yeah. I was born with it.
Yeah.
And like, you looking back, I'm just kind of like, it's there. Chemical imbalance.
Yeah.
Not everyone has had to have a really, really difficult upbringing. And it just happened, yeah? And was it a case, did your parents, were they noticing your behaviour was different if you were sniffing the cans and drinking?
I don't think they did, you know. I don't think so. Because even as we go on to speak about later years, even when I was in the depths of addiction, when I had a very tight grasp on me, nobody knew.
Right, you were good at hiding.
I was like what you'd call maybe the high functioning addict, you know. Even today, like, I could meet people today and they're like, how are you, girl? And, you know, and I'd give them a little bit of my story and they're like, you were in treatment?
Yeah.
What? Do you know? Or people would say they heard that I had gone away to go to treatment and they're like, Rachel, but you don't even really go out, you know? And I suppose, as I stated at the start there, isolation was detrimental for me, you know, and I did a lot of damage on my own. I suppose when I was like in my early teens and probably to my mid-20s, where I was drinking alcoholically and definitely abusing substances, I had a little bit of control. I did. I had a little bit of control. I knew what I was doing was wrong, but I was able to control it a little bit and definitely hide it. And like, as I said there earlier, I became a mom quite early and I moved out of home probably by the time I was 18, if not 19. So I was left to my own devices then as such.
Yeah.
Do you know? So hiding things was quite easy for me.
And then when did you find things were escalating where you might have been using harder drugs?
Yeah. So I suppose in my teenage years, I was probably confined to drink some prescription medication and weed, hash. And then I suppose in my early 20s, the devil came into play, cocaine. I found that. And never in my life did I ever experience the release that that drug gave me. So that started in my early 20s. But like that, I was able to manage it for a while. I had a car crash in 2009 and I was prescribed very strong painkillers. These painkillers I had before and I liked the feeling of them, but kind of took them or left them. But when I had this serious injury in my back and my neck, I was prescribed really strong painkillers. And I remember my monthly prescription would be 224 of these painkillers. At the start, I'd be lucky if they lasted me 10 days. And towards the end, 4 days, maybe.
So how many tablets would you have been taking a day?
Up to 90 a day.
90 strong painkillers?
Like 90, yeah.
We're not talking paracetamol here now. We're talking hardcore prescribed. Yeah.
So then when they ran out, I'd find where I could buy them from people.
Would these have been the black market ones then?
No.
They were just people who weren't taking them. Understood, yeah.
And, you know, I thought it was normal. My doctors prescribed these to me and I was in so much pain. You know, I was like, sure, I just need an extra few. Like, you're supposed to take 8 in 24 hours. I was taking upwards of 70 on the daily.
So would you have started in the morning? Would you have taken 10 in a go?
Yeah. I remember going to work and having like a 2 litre of water. And most of the time, my tablets would come in, you know, dissolvable form. So I would put 20, 30 of them into the water and they might last me till my morning break.
Would you be supping the water and just kind of pretending there was something else?
Yeah, but you wouldn't see it. Yeah. Once they're dissolved, it just looks like water.
Is it kind of a high you would have gotten that dopamine fix?
Yeah, it was definitely a dopamine fix. But I quickly realised, Brenda, if I was to go a day without them, I'd start feeling the effects of the physical withdrawal. But then it turned into hours, you know.
Right.
That I couldn't go a few hours without them. I was fairly dependent on them and I knew it. I knew it from very early on, I knew that. But I didn't care. Do you know, I actually didn't care. It was the other drugs then, you know, like I couldn't get a bag of cocaine without knowing I had my sleepers and my painkillers.
Yeah.
Then it turned into, I can't get my sleepers and my painkillers without getting the bag of cocaine. Drink kind of came in and out of the equation. I probably got drink to make myself look a little bit sociable.
Yes, yeah.
Do you know, and the few friends I did have, if I was going to them, or they were coming to me, that would also be short-lived. You know, I'd make up an excuse as to why I had to go away or they had to leave my house or, you know, because I wanted to use by myself. First of all, to be not judged, I suppose, from the amount of drugs that I was using. And second of all, so I didn't have to share, Brenda, if I'm being completely honest.
Yeah.
You know, and psychosis came into my life. And I kind of knew it was psychosis, but I tried to convince myself that I was depressed and I had anxiety. I had a few things go on in my 20s that I suppose every person does, you know, like bad relationships, breakups, you know, things like this. That I would blame the depression on. I was a single mom with two kids. Now I had outstanding support from my family with my children. But, you know, it's the pity pot.
Yeah.
You know, the poor me. I wish I could do this. I wish I could do that. And the only person standing in front of Rachel was Rachel.
And then, Rachel, for people who don't know what psychosis is, can you describe it?
Yeah, I suppose psychosis is a huge umbrella. But what I was suffering from, thankfully, was drug-induced psychosis.
Yeah.
And I'm saying thankfully there, Brenda, because it can stop. So I used to see things. I used to hear things that were not there. But if you told me when I'm in the psychosis state that they're not there, it would make me very angry, first of all, because I couldn't understand why you can't see what's going on in front of me. Like, as we spoke there at the start of the podcast, that there was a rat infestation in my block of houses. But I used to see the rats in my house.
But they weren't actually there. Okay, they're in the walls, but you see them.
Yeah, they were not there. I took my kids out of bed at 4 o'clock one morning. Took them out of bed because there was hundreds of rats running around downstairs. They were not, Brenda. They were not.
And then your kids, were they like, Mom, there's nothing there?
Yeah. And I used to be like, thank God I can't see them now.
Wow.
Yeah. I remember going over to my very close friend of mine, a neighbour of mine, beating down her door 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, oh, you'll have to leave us in. You know, like, they're after getting into the house. The rats are after getting into the house. And she was like, oh my God, what? So she runs over and she's like, Rachel, there's nothing there. And I'm like, why are you trying to make a fool of me? You know, I'm getting really defensive, mm-hmm. really aggressive. Then I remember I went up to a bedroom in her house to go to sleep. And Brenda, I could hear the rats there as well. And that's impossible. That is impossible, you know. I thought there was people talking to me through the smoke alarms in my house. So I took every single smoke alarm off my house. At one point, I thought there was people trying to come up through the tiles in my kitchen. I have a crack in my tile in my kitchen because I was fully convinced that I still don't know who they were, but they were coming to get me. Psychosis is probably the worst thing I have experienced in addiction. I'd be convinced people were tapped into my phone. Nothing interesting to find in my phone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these thoughts were, they were all consuming.
So scary.
Unbelievably scary.
Frightening.
And anybody who tried to tell me any different. And it was a very, very select amount of people that I told it was going on, because once I sobered up a little bit, I kind of realised how insane I sounded. But still in the back of my head, there'd still be this little, but you're not making it up. It did happen. Because I was never fully sober. You know, I was never fully, fully sober. And I felt embarrassed that it was going on, you know. And I suffered for a long time with sleep paralysis as well. Which I also linked to this depression that I had, which I didn't have. And I remember I used to bring my oldest son into the bed with me, thinking that if he slept with me, then the demons wouldn't come. You know, sleep paralysis, I remember hearing the demon or whatever, you know, come up my stairs. And I used to be like, oh my God, please, please. But you can't move. You can't, you know, you can't speak. And then you'd get the heavy weight in your chest, and absolutely horrendous. I did loads of things to try and stop that, you know, like putting the phone outside the bedroom, like meditating. When I'm actually half laughing to myself now, because I'd be doing all these exercises in a hope that I'd be able to stop all these mad mental things happening to me. But I never once looked at the substances I was putting in my body that were the cause of what was going on for me. It's absolutely insane. Gosh. It is the definition of insanity, you know.
You must have been exhausted.
Yeah, I don't think I slept properly for about 7 or 8 years.
I was going to say, it must have been nearly a decade till you actually slept properly.
Yeah.
Do you know what, Rachel? I must say, your honesty is so refreshing. You're so honest about everything. And even when I rang you a couple of weeks ago coming on the podcast, I really admire your honesty. Going on then, after that, going through all that psychosis, then you were still taking the prescription medication. Mm-hmm. And I really want to lean into the prescription medication because I don't think people understand just how horrific the addiction to codeine is.
It's unbelievable. The grip it gets you. And yes, it is codeine. For me, it started with codeine, but I suppose it branched out onto different benzos as well. All prescription medication that needs to be highlighted, I suppose. Yeah. You know, these are all legal drugs. So I suppose when I did eventually make the decision to sort my life out, a lot of people would know what methadone is, Brenda, you know, and it's an opiate substitute. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. It blocks the receptors in your brain from looking from the opiate. And I thought that was for heroin addicts. Do you know? I that's what I believed it to be. And I was on methadone. I needed assistance. I was on very hard drugs. Very, very hard drugs at the end of my using. Stuff that I said I would never, ever, ever take. And it was the codeine was the worst.
Did you smoke heroin?
Yeah.
Crack?
Yeah.
And the codeine was the worst?
Yeah. 1,000,000%.
Why do you think the codeine was the worst over them?
The psychological effects that codeine leaves in your brain. 1,000,000%. The physical withdrawal from codeine is absolutely vile. It's absolutely vile. And I knew I could not do it on my own. And when push came to shove and I needed to get into a treatment centre and I needed to be there yesterday, I knew I could not detox in the community, is what it's called. I knew I'd use again. I looked for help and thankfully the help is there. And I was able to go on a methadone detox programme. And that allows me into treatment while I'm on a substitute and I can detox in a safe environment then. You know, there is no risk of me relapsing or using in a treatment centre. Whereas I knew if I was doing it at home, I didn't even have to leave my house. Do you know, and I'd be using again.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, as I said to you as well, just as a by the way, and I had said this on the phone to you, I shared a room with a girl in treatment and she was withdrawing from codeine. And I, honest to God, there's a bond the two of us had because I was coming off the benzos. She was coming off the codeine. Mm. And we were by far the worst out of that whole treatment centre. The worst. Yeah. I remember coming off alcohol and
simple.
But those tablets, my good Lord.
The psychological horrific. And the physical effects that the toll that takes in your body, Brenda, it's a huge price to pay. And I know I just kind of skipped past the whole methadone part there. Methadone is very hard to come off as well. There is no qualms about that. It is very hard to come off. But I just thought it was my safest option.
And of course,
thankfully, till today, it has worked out to be my safest option. So I suppose how we got to rock bottom. 2022 came around. We were coming out the latter end of COVID. Yeah. Things were kind of starting to get back to normal.
Yeah.
For the rest of the world. I suppose it's beneficial to mention that COVID affected me in ways I never imagined it that it would. I'm working since I'm 15. Even with my addiction, I always worked. I always held down a job. As I mentioned, I always kind of couldn't settle anywhere, but I would never leave a job without another job to go into. And I did hop around jobs quite a bit, in and out of college, these kind of things. But I suppose when we hit COVID, we couldn't really work. So I was at home quite a bit and I was bored. So I started to use an awful lot more than I had previously done. And when you use a lot more, you spend a lot more. And in my case, I got into a lot more debt. My grandmother that I spoke about at the start as well developed dementia at the start of COVID. And I looking back now, I'm actually so lucky that I got to 31 years of age with that amazing woman, you know. All of my mum's family were all very close with my nan. And she went into a nursing home. That wasn't far at all from where I live. And she deteriorated quite quickly. Now, I must mention that my Nana Breda was 89 when she passed away. So we were all extremely lucky. She had a fantastic life. My nan passed away on the 18th of October, 2022. And by the 18th of November, 2022, there was 25 guards in my house. It was a Saturday evening. I had been down in the range that day. Out of my head. Out of my head. This was 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
What had you been taking?
Coke. Right. And codeine. Cocaine and codeine.
Lethal combination.
Yeah. But that was my everyday cocktail.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Very little food for a long period of time. You know, very little food for a long period of time. Cocaine and codeine. That was my diet every day. And I was sitting at my kitchen table and my front door opened. I never really locked the door, you know. And I don't know if it's all right to say, like, I was putting out a line at the kitchen table.
It's the truth.
And I just turned and I was like, who's that? And I didn't know who it was. I actually thought I was being attacked. There was two men in baseball caps and hoodies, zippies maybe, I don't know. And they said my name. And I was like, who the fuck are you? And I turned, looked at the coke on the table, and when I turned my head back again, there was about 20 high vises in my hallway. And I knew. I knew straight away. I knew what they were there for. And I could feel the life draining from me. So they identified themselves as the Gardaí Síochána. And it's, I suppose, worth mentioning as well, up until this ripe age of 31, I had never, ever, ever, ever so much as given my name to a guard. I'd never been in trouble. Ever. I actually think I had one tax fine previous to this. And, yeah, they came to do a drug raid on my house. Because I thought I was invincible, do you know? Like that, I was never in trouble with the guards before. Why would the guards be looking my direction? I had ran up a huge debt. And I was given what I thought was a very simple way out of it. On a Thursday, I was given a bag and told it would be collected on the Sunday. This was Saturday evening. So the guards took the bag and me with the bag. I went up to Mayfield Guard Station. And that was my first night I spent in a cell. Horrific, Brenda. Absolutely horrific. I kind of laugh now when I think about it because they brought me into a holding cell up in Mayfield and did a strip search. Myself and I think it was either two or three other Bangarda. They did the strip search and they were walking out of the cell. And here's me trotting on after them, you know. And they're turning around, they're like, where are you going? I was like, oh, well, I can't stay in there now. And they were like, but where are you going? Like, I was that naive. I thought that was that. Now they had what they wanted. They had searched me. I was going home. Like, I knew I was in trouble.
Yeah.
But I didn't realise the extent of it all. And to this day, I know now people might laugh when they hear this. But I begged them to leave the door open of the cell. Please leave the door open. And they couldn't, obviously. They could not. And I remember the first time I heard that door bang shut. And anybody who has ever been in a cell will know that that is a very, very loud sound. And even, you know, sometimes, like, if I'm watching telly now and, like, I see someone's house get raided or, you know, or there's a loud noise, it brings me right back to that. I think that, like, them just closing the door solidified so much for me. The mattress is about that thin. And I remember there was a half-eaten hot chicken roll on the mattress and I have a severe allergy to egg. I go into anaphylactic shock if I eat egg. And I remember saying, like, I can't even sit down there because what if there is mayonnaise or whatever, you know? It was just, it was insane. They kept asking me if I wanted something to eat. And I was looking at him going, why do you think I can eat in this kind of a situation? You know, I was fucking sick to my stomach. I couldn't draw my breath. I had a huge panic attack. I didn't know what was going on. And next thing I knew, there was a doctor in the cell with me. And Shemaya's lit up because he was giving me a few D5s. Do you know, I was like, oh, this is great. This will take the edge off. It didn't. Do you know? That was a Saturday night, and the Sunday morning, I was before a judge in Anglesey Street for a special sitting for €28,000 worth of cocaine. Yeah. I remember getting a taxi home, and I got sick in the taxi. I cried my two eyes out in the taxi. I knew I had cocaine, Brenda, but I didn't know it was that much. And the guards, you know, were telling me that comes with a mandatory 10-year sentence.
Oh,
and
God.
You know, it was horrific. And you would think that that would sober somebody up. You know, you would think that that would make someone think, okay, get your fucking shit together here now. It didn't, Brenda. Things got an awful lot worse for me after that day. An awful lot worse. That was the end of November. And by the 23rd of January in 2023, my kids were gone. Do you know? And nobody came and took my children. And I think that's actually harder for me to accept, that my children left of their own free will. They couldn't do it anymore. They could not put up with me anymore. As soon as those drugs were discovered, cocaine kind of left the equation for me. And a lot harder and a lot bigger quantity substances were needed. Things I swore I would never, ever, ever take just became so normal for me so fast. The progression of my disease escalated a million miles an hour. It was pure insanity. I remember ringing my solicitor on a Tuesday afternoon, about 1 o'clock in the day, with a bottle of wine under one hand and a hardcore drug in my other hand, asking him, like, but why can't I see the kids? I don't understand why they think they have the power to tell me I can't see my... What am I doing? Like, picture that. Do you know, I could not see. I could not see.
Blindness of the addiction.
I could not. I genuinely could not see how it had all gone wrong, or how wrong it had actually got. So I suppose from when the kids went, there was we'd say a period of maybe 6 to 8 weeks where I was off my fucking game. I did a lot of things in that period that I am not proud of. I very rarely woke up at home. I either woke up in a cell or in St. Michael's. I put my family through hell. Absolute hell. And I was oblivious to it all. I couldn't see what people were trying to tell me. I thought the world was all against me, you know. And I couldn't see any other way. I could not see the light at the end of the tunnel. I just thought, this is it. I'm fucked. Do you know, there's nothing I can do here. And I suppose a part of me wanted there to be nothing I could do.
Yeah.
I was a bit comfortable in that pain at that time. And that's hard to say that, but I was comfortable. And then there was a knock at my door one day, and it was the guards, which at this point in my life was a regular occurrence. And I remember I went down the stairs and I opened the door and I had no shoes or socks on me. I'm brazen as brass. I was, what the fuck do you want? Do you know, because that's the kind of mindset I was in then, Brenda. And like, that's not me. You know, that is, I'm not, you know, I know there'll be plenty of my family and my loved ones saying, you're not brazen, you fucking are. But, you know, I respect authority and, you know, like, I do consider myself very respectful. And the way my mindset and my attitude changed so drastically is absolutely frightening. So I left the guards in. They were doing a welfare check. I didn't remember, but I had said a lot of stupid things the night before. And I had worried a lot of people who loved and cared for me. So they came to do a welfare check and I left them into the sitting room. It was probably about 4 o'clock in the day, Brenda. My blinds were still pulled and, you know, I had no shoes or socks on me. And the guards were talking away and they were talking away. And to this day, I don't know what they were saying. I have no idea what they were saying. But something else clicked to me that day in my sitting room with those two guards. And they left. And I left straight after them, Brenda. I didn't put on a shoe. I didn't put on a sock. Anybody who knows me, you'd never see me without a cigarette before. Ever, ever. And I had cigarettes and I left them there. You know, and I went up and I knocked at my family's door. And my dad answered. And I suppose he was shocked to see me in a way. And he was a bit apprehensive. You know, because, like I just said, I put them through torture. But I asked him for help, Brenda. And I got it. You know, my family were extremely good to me. My youngest sister took time off work. And we went to an Airbnb for a few days where I tried to dry out a bit, you know. But I quickly discovered that I needed a bit of help. It wasn't working out very well. The more I was sobering up on myself, the more the withdrawals were coming in, ticking fast. The more my memory was coming back, ticking fast. And anybody who's been where we were will know that that's a tough pill to swallow, pardon the pun. You know,
that's the part where you'll want to take something to lock it out.
Off.
Yeah.
Came back up. And my mum and dad had an air mattress at the end of their bed. And it was for me. Because effectively I was under house arrest. They're afraid of their lives, that if I had any bit of freedom, that I'd go.
What age were you then?
I was 32. Since the January, this was the March. So I was like a 5-year-old at the end of their bed. And at the time, I remember cursing them out of it in my head. Being like, they don't fucking trust me as far as they control me. I have to sleep at an air mattress at the end of my mother and father's bed, 32 years of age. But that was the best thing that they done for me. I linked in with Cool Mine above in the Glen. And I started going to AA, NA, CA, smart meetings. They had Here and Now groups. In the hub, and they saved me. They saved me. Everybody who attended those meetings were at a very similar point in their lives to what I was, you know. You didn't have to be sober to attend those meetings. And they just kind of met us where we were. They started talking about residential treatment. I was like, but sure, I'm clean. I wasn't clean. I was taking what the doctors had weaned me down to. I was sticking to my prescription, but how long would that have lasted? You know, I got to see the kids supervised here and there. My oldest son didn't really want to talk to me. And that will tell you, that tells me that I wasn't very sober at the time because I couldn't understand why he didn't, like, I'm in Nan and Granda's now, you know, I'm grand. I could not understand or see the damage that I had done. I knew I had fucked up. But at that time, I was still all in myself.
Yeah.
You know, I was still all in myself because that comes with addiction. You know, you think of only me, 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 me. It's the most selfish thing that will ever, ever happen to anybody. So I agreed to residential treatment. And on the 18th of May, 2023, I went into Ashley House in Dublin which is Cool Minds Mother and Children's Facility. I didn't bring my children because your kids have to be under five. They need to be not in school because obviously you can't bring them to school and all this kind of stuff. I went in on the 18th of May and you'll notice the pattern there. Nana Breda died on the 18th of October. The drugs were found on the 18th of November and I went to treatment on the 18th of May. And I was absolutely petrified. I went in and I was on a methadone detox programme. And it was supposed to take me 4 weeks to detox from the methadone as per instructions from the doctors from here in Arbor House. But if I'm nothing at all in this world, Brenda, I'm determined. If I put my mind to something, I do it. So I was on the methadone 10 days above in Dublin. And the day I finished it, I did the Dublin Marathon with the girls in treatment.
Amazing.
I couldn't even spell marathon before this.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And treatment is fucking hard, Brenda. You know, it's very hard and it's the first time you have to look at yourself and in depth.
How long did you spend there?
I didn't come home until September. So, but I actually moved from the Dublin facility to the Limerick facility in the July, I think. I didn't see the kids, really. For the majority of that time, I came down twice, I think, because Cool Mind will allow you out for weekends once you meet certain criteria. So I saw the kids twice. I saw my partner twice. So I came back in the September and I was still in the illusion, you know, that I'd come back, pick the kids up from their dads and we'd go back and we'd live happily ever after. You know, like this delusional state of mind that I was in. It's 3 years on now and my kids still live with their dad. You know, my two older boys, they still live with their dad. Now I have a fantastic relationship with them and they can come and go as they please. But when I came back, I was like, well, sure, like I'm clean and sober now. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the mom. You know, I can do this. I failed to realise that there had been a year in my children's lives where they had to go and make new lives for themselves. And I suppose that's where the fellowship came in for me in a huge way. That's how the fellowship helps me in a huge way. I am a very active member of AA and I would be going to meetings when I first came home and I would be describing my pain that my children weren't at home with me. And the wisdom and the knowledge you get from those rooms, it's invaluable. It's absolutely invaluable. And it was explained to me, you know, like, you don't run the show anymore. You know, you have to leave things happen as they happen naturally. Today, I have an amazing relationship with my two kids. And I completely understand all of the choices that they make. Like, would I still be sober if my kids came home when I wanted them to come home? Do you know, would I still be sober if I had just picked up life where I had left off? I don't think so, Brenda. You know, because a lot of people say recovery gives you your life back. I don't believe that. I think recovery gives you a new life and it is what you make of it. I have had serious trials and tribulations since I've become sober, clean and sober. Those drugs were not forgotten about, you know. I had a huge court case. The scariest thing I ever did. And in the period of the 6 weeks, we'd say by the time when my kids left till the time I surrendered to my addiction, I picked up a good few charges there as well. You know, things that I did. So I had to face all them and I had to face them all sober, which was fucking shit. My partner is absolutely amazing. He is absolutely amazing.
Had you met him before you went into treatment?
Yeah. We kind of got clean together.
Yeah.
The two of us, you know. We have completely different backgrounds, but we have the same disease. He understands me. I understand him. We fucking kill each other. But that's normal. Mm-hmm. He pulls me up, I pull him up. He's seen me at my lowest points. I've had extremely low lows. In recovery, I I had to deal with that huge court case, and I had never been through the court system before. I'm sure he won't mind me mentioning he has. He has a bit of knowledge, which was extremely beneficial to me. I can sit in the pity pot. I can. I'm very guilty of that. Kenny wouldn't allow that. You know, get up and fucking get on with it. You know, cry if you need to cry, but don't fucking stay there. And it's a great attitude to have, Brenda. You know, he has been a huge, huge, huge rock of support for me these last 3 years. We had a baby. Last August, a little girl, Nisha. She'll be 10 months on
Friday. Gorgeous name.
Thank you. It means warrior.
Oh, I love that. I didn't know that. Such a beautiful name.
Warrior, radiant warrior, actually, it means. She is the light of our lives. She is the absolute light of our lives. My biggest fear when I found out I was pregnant was that I'd need a C-section. And I don't know why this fear came into my head, because I've had two children previously without needing a section. And I remember voicing this concern to Kenneth the whole way through my pregnancy, and he's like, I don't know why you're getting so obsessed with it. It's not going to happen. And if it happens, you're strong enough. But that's something I've always struggled with, believing my own strength or my worth. Lo and behold, the 12th of August last year, I needed a section, an emergency C-section. And I suppose people might be wondering as to why I'd be so apprehensive about the section. I'm an addict. I will be an addict till the day they put me in the ground. No matter if I use again or I don't use again. Whether it's prescribed or controlled, that doesn't make it easier for my disease to comprehend she's getting drugs again, you know? So I was so, so afraid of the pain relief for a C-section. I had voiced my concerns to the doctors from the minute I went in for my dating scan. You know, I'm an addict. I cannot take any addictive medication, especially opiates. I didn't have the easiest of pregnancies with Nisha. So I was kind of in and out of the hospital, and I had really bad pelvic girdle pain. And I don't know how many doctors I had arguments with in CUMH, because they were trying to give me salpidine, a very weak opiate, but an opiate nonetheless.
Yeah.
So in the end, I actually asked a midwife to put codeine allergy on my file, because if you're allergic to it, they're not going to offer it to you.
Yeah.
I had the section, and obviously I had a spinal tap, and I think they give you some sort of morphine or whatever when you're on the table. When the spinal block wore off, the nurses come into the room and they have, you know, those small little containers, and I could see it, and I know what it's like, what it looks like. It was an oxynorm, a morphine based painkiller. So here's your painkiller. And I said, I can't have that. And they're looking at me stupid. They're like, what do you mean you can't have that? And I said, I'm an addict, you know, I can't. Yes, you're an addict, but you just had major abdominal surgery. And I'm like, but I cannot take that. You know, no, it's okay. You're in the hospital, you're controlled. And I was like, Brenda, it's very hard to explain to anybody who doesn't know what it is to feel the addiction. Mm-hmm. I am very strong in my recovery. I hope to remain this strong in my recovery. But that's because I'm clean and sober. If I had taken that medication, I don't know what it would do to my mind, to my persona, you know, what it would alter, what chemical imbalance, it would just tip over that little bit of an iceberg and I'm back to square one.
Yeah, something go off in the brain.
You know, and nobody can guarantee me that. Nobody. I would like to believe that I would have been okay, but I can't guarantee that. And the life I have today, I am giving up for nobody. Nobody. And definitely not a small little brown tablet. You know, that could have put me back 10 years. Was it a struggle? Of course it was. You know, I did have major abdominal surgery.
Yeah.
But I powered through. I looked at my beautiful daughter. I looked at my two older sons. I have three stepsons. Kenna has three sons. I have a life today that I never imagined. I have an extremely simple life, Brenda. An extremely simple life. I don't work because I'm currently pregnant again. So yeah. Nisha's going
when
to
you're
be...
When you due?
Nisha'll be one in August and I'm due this baby in September.
Fab.
So grand and busy. I don't work at the moment. Now, I have gone back to work since I've been in recovery. I don't work at the moment. I run the house as best I can. I get to meetings when I can get to meetings. We have a holiday booked. Myself and Kenneth went on a holiday last year. Like, all these things might seem like small little things. They're not. They're not small things. Because before, I didn't have enough money to get on a bus. Yeah. I didn't have enough money to get on a bus. I own a car. I'm insured in my car. My
drove
car
here
taxed.
Today.
I did. I'm insured in my car. My car is taxed. All these things were alien to me.
Simple things. Before I move on to the final three questions, with the court case, what was the outcome?
They gave me a 5-year sentence and they reduced it to 3.5 years because of my efforts that I made, that I went to residential treatment. And Brenda, they suspended it fully for 2 years for me. So come next February, hopefully that will all be behind me. Very hard.
To have gone through that court case sober, Rachel, I can't even begin to imagine how hard. Now, people listening might be like, most people go through court cases sober. But when you're so used to a crutch and those memories coming up from your past addiction, that like the devil would have been in your head to use again and take away. And to just
1,000,000%.
So to go through that and all the other cases you were saying and to deal with that sort, like that's great admiration for you.
I think the biggest compulsion I had to use was the night before sentencing.
Like, you must have, what do you think was it that you just didn't? What do you think it was? Because that's incredible strength.
Because I remember. I remember the pain. I remember the misery. And it's something I hope I never forget, Brenda.
Rachel, I must say, like, your honesty. You said to me, as I said to you there on the phone a couple of weeks ago, why would you want me on your podcast? I'm telling you now, the amount of people are going to listen to this and even get so much help from what you're saying, identifying in you, like I guarantee you. And I'm so delighted. I've been following your journey online and I'm so delighted.
Thank you.
For you. And Kenneth Fester, I said to Rachel coming in because his name is Fester. I was like, is that his real name, Fester? Probably kill me now for this. Kenneth. He looks like a Kenneth, but he'll always be Fester to
me.
Oh,
he's a Fester. So
is Fester? What's Fester?
Oh, you know, he got it when he was very, very young.
There's someone in some sort of.
That's Uncle Fester from the Adams family.
Fester! There you go. Right, your final three questions. And don't be too worried about these, right? I ask everyone these at the end, and they're all different. There's no answer is wrong. All right? This is you. Rachel, if you could go back to your lowest moment and whisper one truth to yourself, what would it be?
You are good enough.
Number two, what did rock bottom teach you that success never could?
I suppose what I touched on there earlier, you know, having tax in my care, being able to pay my bills, being able to wake up on a Monday morning and not have to worry where I'm going to get the money for electricity because I need my drugs first. You know,
even coming in here today, and I'm speaking for myself as I've been in situations and not worrying about having the shakes or cancelling.
Being able to look somebody in the eye
and not worrying, can they smell the drink off me?
Yeah.
Have I enough tablets to go through this?
They can see my eye is twitching. Yeah. Do you know this kind of a thing? The paranoia is mainly gone. Yeah. No, I'm not going to say it's fully gone.
Yeah. And finally, number three, what's one message you'd give someone who feels like they're never going to make it out?
I remember when I was very young. I was about 11 or 12. And my sister's boyfriend at the time said to me, you know, no matter how bad things get, there is always, always someone 10 times worse than you. Always. And Brenda, I didn't believe that when I was at rock bottom. I thought that there was nothing worse could happen to me. And in the end, I thanked the guard. I actually thanked him, shook his hand and thanked him for coming in to raid my house. Because Brenda, if he didn't, where would I be now? I definitely would not be sitting here opposite you.
No.
I definitely wouldn't have a beautiful child and another one on the way, a beautiful daughter and another one on the way. I just think if I could give any message to anybody struggling. There is always a way. It's not as bad as you think it is. Obviously, when you're in it, it's very hard to see outside it. It's very hard to see the way out. But if you are willing to put in the work, this thing gives you rewards that cannot be measured. You know, and I'm not talking materially.
Yeah.
The life I have with my partner, with my children, with my family, with my partner's family, this simple, joyous life I have today, it's absolutely beautiful.
Rachel, I'm so delighted to see you doing so well, and I'm so delighted you agreed to do this.